Jeff Smith is joining us in the studio. You may have heard Jeff on this show just about a month ago when he was on the phone promoting his new book, Mr. Smith Goes to Prison. It is the tale of what it was like when he got in a little trouble with the feds for lying to the FBI and ended up in a minimum security prison in Southeast Kentucky. And that phrase right there made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. Minimum security prison in Southeast Kentucky, where he was sentenced to do a year and a day behind bars. While he was there, he was not just doing everyday prison life, but also getting some stories together for a book called Mr. Smith Goes to Prison, What My Year Behind Bars Taught Me About America's Prison Crisis. Jeff is back in St. Louis today, his hometown, a town that he served as a state senator for a few years, and is back now to make an appearance and do a book signing tonight at the St. Louis County Library Central Headquarters branch on Lindbergh at 7 o'clock tonight. And since he's in town, I said, come on by and see us in the studio here. And so welcome back to the show, Jeff.
Thanks so much for the invitation. Glad to be here.
Nice to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Last time we were on, we talked about what led you to going into prison and all the rest. And since then, I've actually had a chance to read the rest of the book, because I only had the book for a day before the last time we chatted. Now I've had a chance to read the rest of it. And there are some things in here I've just got to ask you about. And one of them is the fact that a lot of the guys that you met on a daily basis in prison were guys who knew that prison so well because they'd been there over and over and over again, right?
They'd either been in that prison repeatedly or they had been locked up in other facilities. So almost everybody there was there for over a decade, either at that prison or some combination of prisons. So they knew the game pretty well. They knew prison life pretty well.
And you actually had a roommate whose nickname was Red, who everybody called Red, just like the Morgan Freeman character in Shawshank Redemption.
He resembled Morgan Freeman sort of eerily. You know, he was about a 50-year-old black guy with freckles, kind of in the same, you know, very similar complexion to Morgan Freeman.
Yeah.
He had been locked up for most of the past 25 years. And first thing he said to me when I got up to the cell, he said, how long you got? And I said, year and a day. And he said, damn. I've done more time in this joint on the toilet than you got time.
Was he also a guy that could acquire things
yeah.
for you, like Red in the...
He could get pretty much anything he wanted. Yeah, but you know, I say it, you know, in fun, but it was sad. I mean, it was deeply sad to see how many guys had spent the bulk of their life incarcerated. And, of course, it made me realize how lucky I was to only have a year and a day relative to what most of those guys had.
Now, when people talk about a minimum security prison, I think a lot of people still have this image in their mind of, oh, it's a country club prison. That's where the white-collar guys get to go. And what, do you play golf and squash all day long?
I got my handicap down to 8.
Was this a federal prison?
It was a federal prison. And I think, you know, the book really describes the folly of that line of reasoning. At the two prisons at FCI Manchester, there was a medium and a minimum security. I lived in the minimum, worked at the medium security prison, unloading food on the loading dock at the warehouse there. And out of the, I think, 3,000 or so prisoners on both compounds, there were maybe 7 or 8 white collar. So probably, you know, 90%+ drug dealers, most in for crack, some in for meth and oxy.
Mm-hmm.
But overwhelmingly, they also had a gun on their case, right? If there was a gun found, they'd get a mandatory minimum for the drugs, 5 or usually 10 years, depending on the amount that they had. And then an extra 5 years if there was a gun in their car, in their house, connected to their case in any way. So many of them had 15-year sentences, and in the federal system, you got to do 85% of it. So you're going to do 13-plus years.
Wow. Now, the reason I ask you about these guys who had been there repeatedly and knew that prison and the prison system so well is because we jokingly refer to the organization that oversees our prisons as the Department of Corrections. The people who work there are correctional officers. Jeff, in America's prisons, is anything getting corrected?
I saw no discernible attempt at rehabilitation during the time that I was there. There were three educational offerings during 2010. The first was a two-week course on hydroponics, how to grow tomatoes in water.
Mm-hmm. Because a lot of meth dealers want to know that.
and what could better prepare you for a successful reentry to society than knowing how to grow tomatoes?
Because getting out and being a tomato entrepreneur is the way to riches in this country.
In water.
Exactly. So basically that was a front. That course is just kind of a front for this one CO who wanted a few hundred free tomatoes, which, you know, he just, everything that was grown, he threw into his trunk. The second was a GED course that also was very short and taught by a prisoner. The prison had evinced no interest in whether or not prisoners showed up for the course, learned anything, or paid any attention. And then finally, there was a computer course. And this is interesting because it was a month before I got out, it was a mandatory pre-release skills course. So they wanted to make sure everybody understood something about computers because most of the guys there who'd had long sentences, they'd never been on a computer in their life.
Wow.
This is 2010. Mm-hmm. A lot had been locked up for a decade or longer.
They'd never seen an iPhone.
They'd definitely never seen an iPhone.
Yeah.
Although there's some smuggled phones, but they're not like cell phones like we have.
Yeah. It's hard to fit a 6-inch iPhone 6 in the anal cavity. It's probably going to be a flip phone.
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely more flip phone.
One of those throwaways.
Talk about a burner phone.
I definitely don't want to talk on that one.
And the third course was this computer course where there were these 12 computers, and we had basically been salivating over these computers the whole time because you weren't allowed to go in this room where there were 12 brand-new-looking computers. And finally, a month before I was released and a bunch of other people were close to the door. So they sent us into this room, tell us to sign in. So we signed this sheet saying that we were taking the course. And then we sat at the computers. The CO says...
Correctional officer.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do the Appalachian accent to get you guys in the spirit here. He says, all right, y'all. He said, now you see that little button on the bottom right? Need you to push that button. That's going to turn your computer on. So we all went ahead and pushed the button. And then we sat there for 90 seconds in silence, and one of the prisoners was playing with the mouse and asked, hey, does this thing, and the CO says, shut the fuck up.
Mm-hmm.
And then we sat there in silence for another 40 minutes, and then the CO says, all right, you remember that little button on the bottom right? You push it again, and then get the fuck back to your cell. And we did. So that was our computer skills course.
Wow.
But we'd all signed this paperwork so the prison could go and tell the federal government that we had all been trained and they could get a stipend for each of us who had completed the course. So that, you know, when you ask, was there corrections going on? Was there rehabilitation?
Yeah.
I'm describing, I mean, surely this is not every prison is this bad. There are some prisons in the country where there are actual decent things going on, where they're helping rehabilitate people, but I was not in one of them.
So the system is not there to help get these guys ready for going back out into the real world. But I'm curious about the other side of that, which is the guys, the convicts themselves. And as I read in your book, there's different levels of things. And if you're a convict, you're at the top of the hierarchy. So I'm going to call them convicts. Do the convicts want education and training, or do they just want to make it day to day and then get out into the world and try to scrape by?
Most of them do want training. Most of them do express a real interest in coming out and flying straight, starting a business. There's extreme interest in entrepreneurship. I saw in my time there that there's not a single concept that you could learn at Wharton or Harvard Business School that you can't learn inside prison.
Really?
Yep. Whether you're talking about new product launch, quality control, risk management, territorial expansion, barriers to entry, supply chain management. They understood every one of these concepts.
It's just that their product was oxycodone or meth or crack.
Exactly. And you had to be pretty successful to get prosecuted by the feds. If you're a low-level drug dealer, then, you know, the feds aren't going to mess with you.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys had mostly run, you know, decent-sized drug businesses on the outside. And, you know, if you think about it, you got to be pretty good to do that successfully for a while because you're not just competing against, you know, it's like if you're McDonald's and you're running McDonald's, you're competing against Burger King. But in the drug trade, you also could get shot by Burger King, right?
Right.
By everyone in competitors.
Yeah.
And you're probably lying to your family about what you do every day. You know, you've got...
And other McDonald's.
And other McDonald's, too, right? So you've got all these different obstacles to success. And these guys have a tremendous amount of entrepreneurial ingenuity. You could see that in the hustles that they developed in prison. You know, one of the most common misconceptions about prison life is that you've got it made. You know, you got three hops and a cot, you're going to be fine. But really, most prisoners are destitute. They don't have a penny to their name. Most of them get cleaned out because of the nation's asset forfeiture laws, especially drug dealers. Their bank accounts are basically, you know, totally cleared.
Mm-hmm.
And the money's all surrendered to the feds. So they come in, they got no money, and they got to figure out a way to survive, because it's not just you're totally taken care of. If you want deodorant, if you want soap, if you want toothpaste and a toothbrush, you got to pay for it. And you got to pay at prices that are marked up 40 to 50% from what you'd pay on the street for really low quality products.
Mm.
Right. And so you're making for your prison job. I worked full time in a warehouse. I made $5.25. That wasn't per hour. That was per month.
Wow.
So you're making, you know, a couple cents an hour. And if you want to make a phone call back home, it was costing a dollar and a half a minute or so for me to call back home.
Now, yeah, I saw an article recently about the phone call system in these prisons, and it's essentially run by, like, I think two private companies that control all the phone lines, when nowadays on your cell phone you can call from coast to coast for free. You see up to, you know, a few dollars a minute.
Actually as high as $14 a minute. Now, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, just came down with a ruling limiting the price of phone calls inside of prisons to, I think, 14 cents a minute. But for the last, you know, several decades, they've been, you know, these companies have been preying on the most vulnerable people in society, you know, prisoners. And, you know, you can say, hey, screw them. They screwed up, and this is what they deserve. They're getting what they deserve.
But it's not.
It's a really short-sighted view of things, because one of the ways that we know we can reduce recidivism, that is people reoffending, is by keeping people in touch with their loved ones, with their pastors, you know, their friends, their family. So they have community support when they get out, so they don't lose track of everybody. And we know that that's a big factor in helping people succeed when they come back out. If they don't succeed, that means they're going to be a threat to public safety. They're going to cost society a ton of money, both in terms of victimization and in terms of locking them back up and paying $30,000-$40,000 a year every year that they're locked up. So we have an interest in doing little things to help them get back on their feet. And one of the key ways to do it, we made it for decades in this country almost impossible for prisoners to afford.
I want to go back to the business acumen.
Mm-hmm.
If they're so good at business, why is it that when they finally do get out, 80 to 90% of them end up going back in?
Yeah,
is that because that's the only business they know, so they go back to doing what they knew before?
Well, so it's about 70% do end up going back in.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, close. And a disturbingly high number, right?
Yeah.
If any other business in the country had a rate of failure that high...
You'd call it radio.
Yeah. Hey, you've been on for a few years. You must be doing something right, Paul.
Yeah.
But so why do they go back to it? Well, the number one reason they go back to it is financial struggle, right? You come out and you don't have a penny in your name. You got to figure out a way to pay for your halfway house room. You got to figure out a way to pay for your drug testing. You are looking at employers, 90% of whom are going to perform a criminal background check. And when that comes up positive, most of the time, they're never going to hire you. 4 out of every 5 landlords does a criminal background check and won't rent to you. So you got to figure out a place to live. You got to figure out a way to work. You have no money. You might have accrued child support obligations that have accumulated while you've been incarcerated. So... and then I talked to you about the educational and vocational opportunities, you know, that were afforded prisoners.
Right.
Over 650,000 people come back to that every year, come back to the doorsteps of the same communities where they've already failed once before, except now they've got the added stigma of a prison record. And it's really folly for us to believe that they should just magically be able to succeed when there are so few supports in place to help them do so.
You mentioned the criminal background checks. There's a national movement called Ban the Box, because on employment applications, there's always that question, have you been convicted of, or some of them just, have you been arrested for any felony, or some of them just for a crime? And a lot of employers, you know, they got 30 people applying for a job, and they come across one of those where the answer is yes, that one is going right into the trash.
Exactly.
So and I know that there are actually schools, colleges and universities that when you apply, when you fill out the Common App, that question is on there as well. And so you can't even get into a community college or, you know, Mizzou without admitting, yes, I've done time in prison. So we know that those people are discriminated against, and I'm sure that the majority of people who are being discriminated against are people who are already being discriminated against because of the color of their skin, and so now they've got a double whammy against them. But this movement, Ban the Box, seems to have taken off a little bit in the last year or so.
Yeah.
Can you fill us in on where that is? I'm sure you know about it.
So it's in different places in different states, in different cities. A lot of cities have enacted Ban the Box so that when the city is putting out job applications for public sector jobs, then they're no longer asking about that. But it's nothing close to comprehensive, and we need to do something like Ban the Box, I think, nationally. There probably need to be some exceptions. If you are applying for a job for which your criminal conduct is directly relevant, then it's only appropriate that the employer should be able to make a decision, you know, based on your prior conduct.
Mm-hmm.
So you probably shouldn't be able to get a job as a pharmacist if you were a drug dealer. But accepting that...
Well, you know what? You may be actually very well qualified to be a pharmacist if you were a drug dealer.
There's probably some truth to that, but...
Maybe not the dealer, maybe the actual person who made the drugs. Walter White in here. He can work at Walgreens.
There you go. But other than situations where the conduct is directly relevant to what you'd be doing... there's really no reason to continue discriminating against people after they've paid their debt to society.
Let me just play devil's advocate on that point for a second. I'm going to run a criminal background check on you anyway, whether I have that box on the questionnaire or not. So, I mean, even if I think I want to hire Jeff Smith, I'm going to run a criminal background check on him before I bring him in here to work at my bank.
So oftentimes a criminal background check doesn't come till the very end of the process, whereas the application comes at the very beginning of the process. And so... I believe that people should at least have the chance to put forth their best, you know, face and interview and come talk to people in person. And if they want to explain their crime and what they did and why, as I obviously had to do when I came out of prison and I was applying for jobs, then they should have the opportunity to do that without just being knocked out of the box off the bat.
You're now a professor at the New School in New York City, where you and your wife and your one or two kids.
Two kiddos.
Two kids. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And so you obviously turned it around. Did you have to go through that when you applied for that job? Was there a box on your application for that job?
Well, my situation is a little different because my criminality was a little more publicly known than your average person's,
yeah.
Right? So the first line of my cover letter to the New School, literally, I knew they were going to get, you know, for any tenure track or you know, permanent faculty position in the United States these days, you're going to have several hundred applications. And so I knew it would be competitive, and I wanted my application to stand out. And so the first line of my cover letter said, "Last week I stepped out of federal prison." I figured at least they're going to read the rest of that letter, right? But no.
We don't need the box on this one. This guy's admitting it up front.
But in the two jobs that I have now, I have the professorship and then I also work back here in Missouri. When I was a senator, I learned a lot about affordable housing policy. And there were, you know, obviously acute needs in the city of St. Louis. And around the state, because there's a lot of homeless people and a lot of people living in dilapidated houses. And so I got pretty passionate about that, and I ended up taking a job right when I got out of prison helping a Missouri Affordable Housing Policy Agency try to protect state programs that facilitate the development of more affordable housing. In any case, when I interviewed for both those jobs, that housing job I interviewed for, and I answered all the questions, you know, I think adequately. And the woman who on the search committee around the table on their board, she looked at me and she said, "Look, I know that you can do everything we need in this job. You know how to raise money. You know how to build a grassroots organization. You know this policy and you understand the legislative process. And you have connections in Jeff City. You've got everything we want. But why should we be the group to hire you? Why shouldn't we just let some other group hire you? And then in 6 or 9 months, just hire you away from them? Why? Because the minute we hire you, there's going to be an article in the Post-Dispatch saying Missouri Workforce Housing Association hires convict Jeff Smith. And why do we want this stench on us?" Was her question.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
How'd you answer that?
I said, "Look, if you can find someone who brings to the table, the things that I bring to the table, without a felony conviction, then and will work for the pittance that you're offering me, you should absolutely hire that person. And I walked out.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it came across as arrogant and brash, but the question rubbed me wrong a little bit at that moment.
Yeah. Plus, you had just gotten out of prison a week before, and so you were used to standing up for yourself.
Had a little attitude.
We talked about this last time. You're 5'6", 120, and you were in there with guys who were lifting 445 in the yard. So you definitely learned how to stand up for yourself in prison.
I was, but it was a blessing in disguise being assigned to that job in the warehouse, because they put me there, and my six colleagues, as you can see in the picture on the back of the book, my six colleagues weighed in at like 230, 240, 260, 280, 315, and 350.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hard work, you know, because the boxes were 80 pounds mostly, and the bags of rice and beans and flour were 100 pounds. So it was hard given what I came in at. But I tell you, when you go into prison at 5'6", 117, it's not a bad thing to be best friends with six of the biggest guys on that compound. So they looked out for me, and a couple of the guys that I did time with hopefully will be friends for life.
I'd like to delve in a couple of other issues here from this book. On this picture of you and the guys that you worked with, there's a mixture of men of different races, obviously of different backgrounds, but also of different races. But inside the book, you say that inside prison, the races virtually never mix, unless you're all told to stand together in one area by the correctional officers. You don't eat together. You don't talk together. If you do, you're asking for trouble. And yet you're friends with these guys. You know, they're Latino, black, you're white. How did that happen?
Well, two ways. Number one, those are my colleagues at the warehouses. So we spent 40 hours a week together, you know, every day for almost a year. And so you're doing hard work and you're in close quarters. And so, you know, to some degree you bond. Although one of the Latino guys there and one of the black guys got in a couple fist fights during our time at the warehouse. So there were some, you know, ups and downs, but a lot of us bonded. And second of all, you know, basketball has always been kind of a vehicle for me in life to kind of build bridges across racial lines. And playing basketball, I was usually, you know, I was basically the only white guy in the, you know, in the prison that played in the league, the main prison league. And that helped me build relationships with
and the shortest guy.
Thank you for reminding me. You know, I'd forgotten how short I was, but I appreciate that. You know, but my first night there, as I write about in the book, you know, I went and sat down to eat in the chow hall, and the only guys I knew were my celly and the two guys in my cell block next door. And so I sat down with them, and the whole place went silent.
Because they're black and you're white.
Right. And my celly looked at me and said, he said, how many white folks you see? Look around. How many white folks you see eating with the kinfolk? I said, none. He said, all right then. He said, don't think we're jumping in to save you. Oh. And so I got up and left.
And then did you hear it from white guys too?
I did. As I walked back on the yard, kind of one of the leaders of the whites on the compound named Cornbread, who was an Aryan Brotherhood member, told me in no uncertain terms not to ever break bread with black people.
Hmm. But you did, because you were friends with these guys on the from the warehouse.
I mostly did not. I mostly heeded that counsel.
I also want to ask you about, you talked about the prison underground economy and how Red, your cellmate, could pretty much get anything. We hear stories about how prisoners treat other prisoners in prison. And in particular, we always hear stories about child molesters or those involved in child pornography, that when they go to prison, they are looked down upon by every single person in there and possibly are open to physical harm. Were there any in the prison that you were in, and is that true?
It's very true. And there were a couple suspected pedophiles who were shunned, and one was beaten up, and one went to protective custody, I think, just turned himself in. Basically, you know, you go and you say, look, I'm not safe here, and I need to be alone.
Does that mean he goes into solitary?
Yeah.
For the rest of his stay?
I don't know exactly whether you can say you want to get out you know, or whether once you turn yourself in, you're at the whim of the prison. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, the two groups that are in the most difficult situations inside a prison are pedophiles and snitches.
Mm.
Anybody who is a known snitch inside a prison is going to have a very difficult time.
Now, let's talk about this for a second, because I'm curious. We always hear, you know, snitches get stitches.
Yeah.
It's a slogan I picked up on the street.
Yeah, and in prison they call it the buck 50. Like, if you snitch, you're going to get a buck 50.
What does
like,
that mean?
Somebody's going to come at you with a shank or a slock, like, you know, just a some type of weapon, then you're going to get some cut that requires 150 stitches to heal.
Wow. I actually know what a slock is. It's a padlock or something else, sometimes a big rock stuffed inside a sock that they swing and hit you in the face with.
Correct.
Wow. So there have to be corrections officers who want to get information from prisoners about what's going on inside there. And so by definition, there have to be snitches.
There are.
How does that work?
Well, there's always going to be people that want a little edge over other prisoners. Whether it's like an extra helping of meatloaf, you know, on meatloaf night, or an extra, you know, just little more time on the weight pile, you know, some little privilege. And there's always prisoners that think that, you know, that it's worth it to get something like that, to rat someone else out for their hustle, if it's illegal, or someone who's smuggling contraband into the prison. So, yeah, there were the best what you learn to do inside a prison, you learn to see things without actually seeing them, you know. You learn when you see something, someone doing something illegal, the last thing you want is them to see you seeing them. Because once you know about whatever they're doing wrong, then you're vulnerable, right? Like, because they don't want you to go tell.
They don't know if you're a rat.
They don't know if you're a rat. And so you just need to learn how to, before you even it even registers with you, look away and don't let anyone know that you saw what they were just doing.
Mm.
And
by the way, that is one of the 10 rules in this book. Jeff has 3 or 4 pages in here that in which he lays out 10 rules that you need to know. By the way, because he was a professor and a politician, there are subparagraphs to the rules. I laughed out loud when I read it, just because of the formatics of it. Because if you went to prison and you told somebody, I got 10 rules for you, there wouldn't be subparagraphs, Jeff. But there are in here. You know, is valuable information just in case you ever are going to be in the Gray Bar Hotel there. Before I let you go, and I know you've got to run off and do other things, and I appreciate you coming in here today. The book is subtitled, What My Year Behind Bars Taught Me About America's Prison Crisis. If I put you in charge of America's prisons, our correctional facilities, what would you reform? Give me 3 things that would be at the top of your list that you would reform.
Okay, number one, I would make it a lot easier for people to see their loved ones while they're incarcerated. It's hard enough to return to society and to assimilate and be successful as it is, but we make it much harder by making it so cost prohibitive, so expensive for people to stay in touch with loved ones. So I would make phone calls, you know, next to free. I would make visits easier. And more frequent, you know, and because right now there's limits on how many visits you can get, when people can visit you. And so I would change that. Number two, I would institute more educational and vocational training. In other countries, there's other countries that have recidivism rates less than a fifth of America's, okay? Countries that have recidivism rates of like 10%. And that's because when you go into prison in those countries, they say, look, what are your talents? What are your skills? And how can we spend the next 6 years while you're going to be in here figuring out a way to teach you, kind of supplement whatever you can do and align your skills with skills needed by employers in the community to which you'll return. And once they align those things, people, not surprisingly, are usually able to get jobs when they come out. And once they have jobs, then they're not going to reoffend. So that's the second thing I'd do. And then the third thing is that I'd change the whole incentive structure. You know, one of the chapters at the end is entitled something close to see you in 6 months or see you next year,
yep.
Jackass.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what COs would tell prisoners when they were leaving. And they would sometimes say, one guy would say, you know, it's jackasses like you that remind me I'm always going to have a job. Right? They viewed prisoners as job security. We've got to change that whole mentality. The best way to do it would be to find a way to track prisoners when they leave. And then for every year that they don't reoffend, give a bonus, like a $1,000 stipend or bonus, to all the correctional officers who guarded them at the previous prison.
Huh.
And that way, instead of constantly just dehumanizing people on the inside and tearing them down to where they just feel like they're worthless by the time they get out, prison guards would actually have an incentive to lift people up and try to equip them, you know, with the skills they need to succeed.
But that's not going to happen in a country where we are privatizing our prisons, and we've got big corporations that want to make more money, and the way they make more money is by getting more people to go to prison and go back to prison.
That's a big problem, especially when companies sign contracts with county and state governments guaranteeing, where the government guarantees that 95% of all the beds will be filled for the next 20 or 30 years.
Mm.
I mean, horrible public policy. And so you're right. That is definitely an obstacle to doing something that would reduce mass incarceration.
The book is called Mr. Smith Goes to Prison, What My Year Behind Bars Taught Me About America's Prison Crisis. Jeff will be at the Central Headquarters Library of the St. Louis Public Library tonight. That's on Lindbergh, 7 o'clock. He'll be speaking and signing books and answering more questions for you tonight, and I'm so glad that you were able to turn things around here and turn this into an opportunity in so many ways for yourself, for your family, and for others through this book, and I appreciate you coming back in today.
Thank you so much, Paul. Thanks, Ian, and everybody out there, don't lie to the feds.
Jeff Smith here on the Large Morning Show in the afternoon on the Big 550 KTRS.